Hey, what's up, guys? Travis here. And if you've been following me or my story for any length of time, you know that I started a company called Guestio about a year and a half ago now. And one of the things that we are doing this year in 2022 is we're building a concierge program called the Fast Pass that allows you to get booked on top quality shows and platforms for the purpose of spreading awareness for your brand, grabbing attention, growing your credibility, your authority, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you are listening to this right now and you are a seven-figure plus entrepreneur and you have a budget to bring in traffic, attention, credibility, authority to your brand, then this might be a really great program for you. Just head over to travischappell.com/10K. Why 10K? Because we guarantee in this program that you're going to be able to speak in front of 10,000 people within 90 days. Okay, 10,000 people within 90 days. Imagine getting on a stage in front of 10,000 people to share your message, your story. Well, that's exactly what we are doing inside of this program through virtual stages like podcasts or virtual events or YouTube channels or blogs. You name it, we are working with it and we are trying to get you booked on those platforms. So travischappell.com/10x. There's a quick application there. And then right at the end of that application, it'll prompt you to set up a phone call where you'll jump on a call with me and we'll talk through whether or not you're a great fit for this program. Please act fast on this. Do not wait because we are only taking on one or two clients a week due to constraints with our team and the limited supply of high quality shows and platforms that are out there in the market. So if that's you and you're really wanting to explode your brand in 2022, head over to travischappell.com/10K, fill out the application, schedule a quick phone call, and you and I will chat really soon about whether or not this would be a great fit for you. Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
Hey, this is Mark Manson, author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. If you want to build better relationships with others, you should be listening to the Build Your Network podcast with my good friend, Travis Chappell.
If you're tired of the old way of networking, the business cards, the awkward conversations, and the aggressive pitches, but you know how crucial your network is to your success in life, then you're in the right place. Welcome to Build Your Network, the only top-rated show committed to helping you master content networking, foster real relationships, increase your authority, and build the network of your dreams. Listen in on conversations with world-class entrepreneurs, authors, thought leaders, and more as we deconstruct their best strategies for your success. So get ready to burn your business cards, ditch the name tag, and discover the new way to network with your host, Travis Chappell.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Build Your Network. Today, I am super stoked to have on Mark Manson. Mark is a two-time number one New York Times bestselling author whose books have sold over 13 million copies now worldwide. It's been translated into more than 60 languages and hit bestseller lists in 16 different countries. According to Amazon charts, his book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, was the most read nonfiction book in all of 2017. And he's now been published and featured in over 50 of the biggest newspapers, magazines, and television shows on the planet, including NBC, CNN, Fox News, Time Magazine, Larry King, New York Times, New York Post, USA Today, BuzzFeed. If you've heard of it, he's been on it essentially at this point. So I'm super excited to bring Mark Manson on the show. Mark, what's up, man? Thanks so much for joining me.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, sir. So I want to build a little bit of context for those listening, for maybe like the three people who haven't heard of you or your books or seen the orange cover in an airport at some point in their lives. And I want to rewind the clock a little bit and go back in time here. Let's talk early life, 12, 13 years old. You know, where'd you grow up? What were your parents doing at the time? And how did that kind of influence the direction? And let me kind of preface this, by the way, for those of you listening to the show, you know that we typically don't use a lot of cuss words or anything like that, but I have to caveat that because literally both of Mark's books have the word fuck in them. So if you're not somebody that enjoys hearing those types of things, then maybe move on to the next episode. But if you can make it through, please stick around because it's going to be a lot of fun to have this conversation. So Mark, question for you, 12, 13 year old, set the scene. Tell us what life was about for you back then.
12, 13, I was a little misfit. It's bittersweet. Always talking about my hometown because where I grew up is completely different now than it was back then. So I grew up in Austin, Texas. Mm. Now everybody and their dog wants to live in Austin, Texas these days. And it's a very cool city, but it's completely different than it was back in the 80s and 90s. And I used to live in Round Rock, which used to be a exurb, like way outside the city. Now it's just like another part of the city because it's gotten so big. But it was kind of a conservative suburban area in Texas. You know, it's everybody now thinks of Austin as kind of the San Francisco of the South. And that is true if you're like within maybe say 5 miles of downtown, but you get 10, 15 miles away from downtown and you're in Texas. So I grew up in a conservative area, went to church 2-3 times a week. You know, parents were not old fashioned, but they're actually pretty modern. But I mean, it's like they were both old school Texans. And so it's like, this is the way they grew up. So this is the way I was going to grow up.
Traditional in that.
Yeah. Sense. Yeah. Just, you know, this is what you did every week. Yeah. And I did not like it. I did not fit in. I always joke that the two most important things in Texas are Jesus and football. And I decided when I was around 11 that I didn't believe in the Jesus thing. And I was absolutely terrible at football. So I just kind of found myself as an outcast.
Yeah. 11 years old to be growing up. I grew up in a really, really religious type of a home. Just a quick context. I graduated kindergarten, eighth grade, high school, and college on the same campus, which is also the campus that I went to church on. And so I definitely understand the growing up in a bubble atmosphere. And I find it fascinating that you decided for yourself at 11 that you weren't on board with the God thing, which, you know, regardless of your family situation in general, like where you were in that geography, that whole culture believes that. It wasn't just like, oh, when I'm with my family, they say these things. It's like everybody around me believes this. Why do you think that you were able to make that adult of a decision when you were 11?
Well, looking back, like I always hated church. And I, even when I was a little kid, 5-6 years old, and I never understood why. And I think it wasn't until I was maybe 11 or 12 years old that I started to kind of put things together. I mean, it never made sense to me. Like it never, you know, it was like, I would go to school and learn about math and science and history. And it was, you know, it was like X caused Y and Y caused Z. And then you go to church and it's just like random stuff is supposed to make sense. You know, like it never fit together in my mind. But I think the other thing was just, and this is going to sound very cynical and mean, and I don't mean this in a cynical or mean way, but I started to find that a lot of the people, including my parents, but you know, a lot of people in that community were very two-faced, I guess is the word. You know, it's, they would say things publicly at church, but then you'd kind of go off to dinner with them and you'd hear them or you'd watch what they did. And it was the complete opposite of the things they were saying. You know, it's like, I would see my parents talk shit at the dinner table about, you know, the people they couldn't stand at church. And then we'd go to church the next day and they'd be like, oh my God, it's so good to see you, and hugging each other and everything. And I'm like, this is such bullshit. Like,
I'm laughing and nodding my head vigorously in agreement because I literally was having this conversation. So my assistant that works for me, we grew up in a very, very similar environment. We went to the same school since we were like in third grade. And we were talking about this exact thing, how I was like, probably one of my biggest triggers now as an adult is blatant hypocrisy. And it stems directly from growing up the way that I grew up. And I found the exact same thing to be true, is people portraying themselves to be a certain type of individual or person, and then not being that person behind closed doors. And like that now frustrates me to no end, and I can't stand it. And I'm sure it has to do a lot with the fact that I saw it live itself out in a multitude of ways when I was younger. But anyway, sorry to interrupt. I felt like I had to explain why I was nodding my head so much during that answer.
No, it makes sense. And it's funny too that, I mean, you've kind of built a business around relationships. You know, when I started my business, it was around dating and relationship advice. And one thing I kind of discovered early on in my career is that I just had this obsession for authentic relationships. Like it just, dishonesty or not portraying your true feelings, like it just drives me crazy. It's just a personal tick of mine. And I think a lot of it comes from growing up in that sort of environment. And it's not, and I'm not saying this to trash, you know, religious people or certain Christians or whatever, you know, I think lots of human group, most human groups do stuff like this. I think when I look back now, I'm actually much more sympathetic to religion now as an adult than I was, you know, as a teenager or a kid. I just think in communities like that, there's such a premium put on kind of solidarity and conformity that it's, you know, you people just kind of fall in line and say the right things. And it's just understood that that's what you're supposed to do in those sorts of environments. I didn't understand that then. I was like, the adults are lying to each other. What do I do about this? Like, you know, like that's all I could understand. But like now that I'm older, I kind of get it. It's some cultures really demand that level of, I guess, solidarity from each other.
Right. So you grew up in Austin, kind of felt like an outcast, never fit in, make these kind of adult level decisions at that young of an age, and which probably further isolated you from probably the rest of your peers in that sense. I know that you ended up moving out to Boston, and that's where you went to college. Why did you choose there? Any specific reason?
To get out of Texas. I remember I went on a East Coast trip with my dad to when I was like 16 or something, and we went to Boston, New York, and DC. And I was just, from the first moment we landed, I was like, this is where I mean, like, I need to be on the East Coast. It's funny, growing up in Texas, I think because of that almost like compulsive need for authenticity or honesty, I was seen as a dick in Texas. You know, it was like, I was the guy who said the thing that nobody was, you know, it's like, everybody's thinking it, but you're not supposed to say it. Like, I was the guy who said it, you know, and then you go to Boston and everybody's like that, you know? So moving to Boston is one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. And to me, it was because of the culture. It's the first time in my life that I ever actually felt like I fit in. And I think part of it was the authenticity thing. And then I think part of it too was, you know, I was always a very kind of intellectual and philosophical kid, which again, where I grew up, that wasn't really respected. Right. You know, you were actually made fun of.
Mumbo jumbo. Yeah.
Yeah. If you used a big word, like people made fun of you or thought you were better than them or something like that, you know, and it's in Boston, people respected that, people were impressed by it. So for me, it was just a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. So talk to me then about the next phase of your life, right? Because the subtle art didn't come until 2016 and you were in college 2007. Is that right?
I graduated 2007. So 2000.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a 9-year period there where, you know, I know you had a self-published book and like you said, started writing some blogs on dating and different things like that. When you graduate college, you're probably not thinking like, oh, I'm going to be a blogger now, right? So I'm sure there was some sort of a discovery phase or an obstacle or wall that you came up against where you were like, oh, I don't actually want to be doing this thing that I studied. I want to be doing this other thing. Let me just go. And then you went on a trip and traveled around for a while and traveled around the world and then wrote blogs and then came back and wrote this book and had a meteoric rise after that, which I want to get to. But what happened in that in-between time and how did you kind of discover what the next step was going to be in your life?
So I in school, I actually studied, I intended after school to go into finance. And honestly, looking back, I don't think I really thought it through very much. I was playing a lot of poker back then and I was kind of good at it. And so I figured like finance was like the logical analog to that. The problem was like I graduated into like the biggest financial crash in 90 years. So jobs weren't really available. And so I was living on a friend's couch and just like trying to make ends meet. And one of the things that I was doing, like I had learned at some point along the way, I'd learned how to like make basic web pages. And so I started doing a little bit of freelance web design and web work just to like pay the bills, you know, pay my friend back for letting me sleep and crash on his place. And it was around that time I read Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. And it, for people who aren't familiar with that book, it was a huge, huge kind of cultural moment. I think it came out in 2008, where basically what he argued was like, you know, you can build systems online that essentially, you know, you can automate an entire business online so that you can make money while you sleep. And they don't even have to be big businesses. You know, you could just build something that makes you $1,000 a month or something on the side. And I read this book and I'm like, oh my God, this is mind blowing. I have to do this. And so I spent the next 2.5 years working like 16 hours a day, trying to build something that would let me work 4 hours a week. And you know, so through the process, I'm building affiliate marketing websites and AdSense websites and SEO networks and just doing all this crap, and like none of it's working. And back then, the kind of the big strategy, if you wanted to get traffic, was to start a blog. Blogs were kind of like podcasts before podcasts. Like it was like the big growing space. And so I started blogging for a few of my websites, and one of them was like a dating relationship website. So it was like, I would promote match.com and I'd get $5 if somebody signed up through my link or whatever. And so I'm writing these blogs for this dating relationship site. And it started to take off. And I noticed too, that the more I kind of shared about my own, because I was a single 25-year-old guy at the time, the more I shared about my experiences dating and, yeah, and my relationships and things like that, the more people came and the more they read, the more they signed up and wanted to read more. And that was the beginning, essentially, of my blogging career. It was complete accident.
Yeah. So how did that end up going? You obviously did pretty well, enough to let you kind of live an autonomous lifestyle and create a life that you wanted, right? So how did that end up going, and what happened to spark the idea of writing more like life philosophy style books, like what you're doing now?
Yeah. So it took a year or two till I was making kind of like a modest full-time living, you know, maybe a couple $1,000 a month or something like that. And I had always dreamed of traveling the world. And so it's, you've got a business online, you can work from anywhere, you know, 25, making a couple grand. It's like, all right, let's go to Asia. Let's go to South America. Let's go to Europe, start experiencing all those things. And so I just kind of built up the business slowly over a number of years. And then it was around 2012, I want to say, yeah, maybe 2013, I started realizing something, which was, you know, well, let me back up a second. So when the blog started to get popular, one of the things I did was I realized, I'm like, I should actually know what I'm talking. Like if people are actually going to read this thing, I should probably know what I'm talking about. And so I started doing a lot of research into like psychology and, yeah, attachment theory, and learning all about the field and making sure I'm actually giving decent advice to people. And one of the things I discovered as a couple of years went by is that pretty much anybody who has major relationship issues in their life, really what they have is an issue with themselves. You know, it always starts with yourself. So it's like, if your relationships keep falling apart, it's not because you're sending the wrong texts or you're inviting people to the wrong restaurant. It's because you're an asshole, or you have low self-esteem, or you're insanely insecure about something. You know, there's some internal individual thing going on. And so I realized after a while that like, there's kind of almost no point in just talking about the relationship stuff if you're not going to talk about the individual stuff first. And so as I kind of dive more into those topics, kind of, I guess, traditional like self-help topics, the site grew even more. And then it just reached a point where I'm like, you know what, like, I'm going to rebrand myself as just kind of like a generic self-help author or
yeah,
life advice giver. And when I did that, things just took off like crazy.
Talk to me really quickly about your relationship with the rest of the self-help industry, because I feel like, I get the feeling, Mark, that you identify as self-help, but not really. So can you give us just like a quick explanation of what you feel like that industry is and how you differ?
Yeah. So I often tell people that, you know, my work is self-help for people who hate self-help. It's kind of like an anti-self-help in a lot of ways. Because I'm very outspoken and critical of kind of the traditional self-help tropes. You know, I think positive thinking is kind of bullshit. I think the law of attraction is definitely bullshit. I think a lot of kind of the woo-woo energy stuff that most people talk about, you know, it's just, it's very masturbatory. It's weird in that I'm still seen as a self-help guy. Well, let me put it this way. I think a lot of my audience, the reason they're drawn to my work is because they're like me. You know, it's like they want to improve their lives. They want to, you know, be happier and have better relationships and feel better about themselves. but they don't buy into kind of all the cheesy stuff.
But they don't want to bathe in crystals every morning or something.
Exactly, exactly. Right. But at the same time, the people who do bathe in crystals every morning, for some reason, think I'm one of them. And so you end up with this very awkward situation sometimes where I get invited to things and people are very disappointed horrified by the things that come out of my mouth. So there's a funny story I'll tell you. I got invited to a conference in Europe back in 2015. And back then I didn't do a whole lot of live speaking yet. And so I was just, the fact that I was invited to a conference and I was going to get flown over and paid some money was like huge, you know, it was thrilling for me. So I accepted. I didn't really look too far into like who these people were. So I show up and it's one of these, you know, woo-woo spirit crystals type things. And I like go in there the first morning and the first speaker gets up on stage and he starts talking about like, you know, visual energetics. And he like makes us do this exercise where we have to like stare into the eyes of the person sitting directly next to us for like 3 minutes and share everything that we're feeling. And I'm just like, oh God, this is not gonna end well. And, you know, sure enough, I got up on stage the next day and did my thing. And I think pretty much like half of the room hated my guts. Yeah. I actually had people come up to me like very angry afterwards, telling me I was wrong. Why was I here? And I'm like, I really have no idea. So I don't have much of a relationship with the self-help industry.
Oh, that's funny. It's funny to me because I feel like in that self-help industry, there's a lot of the same, circling back to the beginning of the conversation, there's a lot of those same hypocritical type people in there as well. There's a lot of like the fake it till you make it crowd that's in that industry of people pretending to live this type of a life and you should pay me for all of the things to help you live a life like I live. But it was really totally a facade and they didn't have any of the things that they said that they were doing. And so I figured you probably had a little bit of opposition to identifying in those circles as well.
The whole industry there's an epidemic of narcissism in the industry. And I think it's because, you know, narcissists generally feel very good about themselves. That's why they're narcissists. And so I think a lot of these people, they start developing, like what they see as self-improvement is actually just developing narcissistic tendencies, and which makes them feel very good all the time. Mm. But part of that tendency is like, oh my God, I need to share this with others. People should pay me for this. And it kind of creates this like pyramid scheme of narcissism. And I have no interest in participating.
Yeah, a lot of it's the religion of self, right? It's the same tenets. And I like in your second book, and Everything is Fucked, you go in that chapter about how people create religions all the time. And which one of the most fascinating things that I've read. It's all the things that I've been thinking for the past few years as I've been like navigating adulthood, leaving the way that I grew up. And you just articulated extremely well. And I wish we had more time to go into that, but I want to move on into the story here and talk a little bit more about how the initial book, The Subtle Art, came into existence. And then
sure.
I just want to hear what that journey was like, man, because very few people have just meteoric rises with a singular output, like one piece of content that you put out that just hit the perfect person that you were trying to reach and spread like wildfire and now has been on the top chart, the New York Times bestseller list for like 200 weeks in a row or something like that, and sold over, you know, 10 million copies or something now. And it's just like that kind of a story is crazy. So I'd love to hear you just kind of like, you know, 30,000 foot view, give us an idea of where the idea came from. And then at what point you realized that you had something.
Yeah. So if you back up to like 2013, 2014, my blog starts really taking off. And one of the things that was really taking off was kind of actually just what we were just talking about, is I started writing. Now that I had stepped out from the relationship umbrella, I felt more free to write about these other topics. And one of them was pointing out kind of the narcissistic tendencies of typical self-help or self-improvement. And so I'd write posts called, you know, you are not special, or, you know, it's why you're wrong about everything, or things like that, or in defense of being average, stuff like that. And they would just take off, maybe they'd go viral and they get shared everywhere. And I discovered that there was a very wide audience of people kind of with my background and my age and my generation who had a similar feeling of like everything I grew up being told was good is kind of bullshit and, or didn't work, or it didn't really turn out the way I expected it to. And so there's kind of like an abiding cynicism that I was tapping into. And I was experiencing a lot of this in my own life as well. You know, I built an online business. I'd been traveling all around the world. I had been, you know, doing like living kind of the Instagram life, you know, going to all the parties and events and doing selfies on the beach and all this stuff and having all these crazy experiences. But it was very unfulfilling. And it all felt, after a few years, it all felt kind of meaningless and pointless. And so I had a little bit of, I guess, like a mini midlife crisis in my late 20s, kind of realizing like, wow, everything I've been working towards, like my entire 20s, is actually like pretty superficial and self-absorbed. And, you know, what do I actually care about? Like if I died tomorrow, would I be remembered for anything? Or what would I want to be remembered for? I started asking myself a lot of these like very difficult questions. And I guess the book Subtle Art was like very much an answer to those questions for myself. And I think that process of like, what are my values? What is actually worth caring about? You know, I know just making a lot of money or buying a big fancy house, like these are not goals that are worth giving my, you know, that's what our parents spent their lives trying to get. And we saw how that turned out. So it's like, what are we going to pursue instead? You know, I think a lot of people of my generation, like we're going through these same questions and issues at the same time. And so I think the book just hit a nerve. It was kind of the right questions and the right title for the right demographic at the right time.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate in that.
Yeah. So was there a spike, like a big spike that you remember happening that, or was it just kind of steady growth the whole time as soon as the book launched? Or,
you know, so it was funny when it came out, there was a spike when it came out. So it debuted on the New York Times list, I think like number 6. And that was at the time, like that was the whole goal. It's like, all right, just get on the Times list. And then, you know, for the rest of my life, I can be a New York Times bestseller. I never really expected much more than that. And it stayed on the Times list for a few weeks. And then it dropped off and kind of trickled, you know, sales were decent, but not crazy. And then it really started to come back like 2 or 3 months later. And it was interesting. It was the audiobook that took off first. The audiobook, for whatever reason, Amazon's algorithm on Audible just like started recommending it to everybody.
Yeah.
And then once it took off, the hardcover started taking off. But I'll say this, like people ask me this a lot, you know, it's what does it feel like? You know, you asked it earlier, like what does that meteoric rise feel like? What is it like being caught up in that? And I'll say that it's very strange as an author, because I think, you know, if you're like a musician who just hits it big, you're playing in arenas to like 30,000 screaming people singing your songs with you. You know, if you're a movie star that just hits it big, like you're getting stopped on the street every single day by fans. If you're an author that hits it big, nothing changes in your life. Like absolutely nothing. Like nobody knows who, like what you look like, who you are. You know, it's like the only thing that changes is like a nice fat royalty check shows up every 6 months, which is great. But like your day-to-day life like really doesn't shift. And then I think too, you know, for authors, it does happen so gradually that there's not really any single like, oh shit moment. You know, it's like from end of 2016 through 2018, book sales increased probably like 3 or 4% a month, which when you compound that over like 25 months or whatever, you know, you end up getting just this massive surge of sales. But it's just, because it takes 2 years, that like that whole upward trajectory, it takes 2 years. There's never like a single moment of like, oh my God, I made it. It's just this weird thing that's always going on in the background of your life.
Yeah, sure. That makes a lot of sense. I appreciate taking a second to explain that. We're coming up on time here, man. And usually this is the part of the conversation where I talk a little bit more about relationships and networking, but I got to apologize to my audience because I got to be selfish here and spend the last couple minutes talking about something that I've wanted to talk with you about for since I read both your books. And it's going to be pretty deep here for the last 10 minutes or so, because I want to ask you this question. Why are we here, Mark? What's the purpose? What's the purpose? What's the meaning of life, man? That's essentially what you're writing about, and I find your perspective on it to be pretty fascinating. And so I kind of just want to have this conversation with you.
I mean, this is where I just say 42 and hang up, right? So this actually segues in nicely with talking about the meteoric success of Subtle Art, because something interesting happened after the success of Subtle Art, which was, it was something I completely did not expect. I, being like a big best-selling author, like that had been a dream of mine pretty much my entire adult life. And once the blog started to do well and I was making a living off of it, it kind of became like my life goal of like, you know, one day I want to be a best-selling author. I want to be on the New York Times list, you know, want to like go do a book signing somewhere, have a bunch of people show up. And I kind of had this like laundry list of life goals, you know, sub life goals. My, you know, it's like one day I want to sell a million copies and I want to be on TV and I want to like do this. And it was always, you know, one of those things in the back of my head of like, okay, over the next 20 to 30 years, I will like slowly check off each of these off my like life dream list. And when Subtle Art took off like that, I knocked out all of those in like 3 months. And so I found myself, you know, in my head, I've got this like list of goals that I'm going to be working my entire adult life towards. And they were like, I knocked them all out in 3 months. And so I was actually like completely lost afterwards. I actually became depressed for about 6 months simply because I had no idea what to do next. It's like, how do you ever top this? Like, what, everything I've dreamt about for the last 10 or 12 years just happened. And I'm still the smelly, farting idiot getting up, you know, struggling to get out of bed every morning. You know, it's like, oh crap. Like, what do I do now? And so a lot of what informed the second book was kind of this obsession about like, what is meaningful? Like, what is doing something meaningful? And how do you know if it's meaningful? I definitely am an existentialist in that I don't think there's any inherent meaning to life. I think it's something that we create. And I think it's incumbent on us. Like, we all have a responsibility to create it. And I think meaning can be created in multiple ways. But ultimately, anything that is meaningful, what it comes down to is some sort of service of others. And whether that's through simply loving somebody, helping somebody, creating something that enriches the life of somebody, anything that humans tend to experience as meaningful and important in the world, we experience it as meaningful and important because it has some sort of service to other people. And so it's one of those things where like you spend like the first 30 years of your life thinking like you're a rebel and a badass, and then you like mature enough to realize that all the cheesy cliches are true. Like the whole point of this is to simply be good to others, to love others, and to hopefully along the way be loved yourself. And that's something that, you know, 25-year-old Mark would have like rolled his eyes and been like, lame. But, you know, it's 35-year-old Mark is like, okay, yeah, this is why all these movies are made about this. I get it.
Well, I'd love to have a part two of this conversation at some point in the future and just talk only about that one thing, because that's what really fascinates me at this point. But I do want to ask you this last question before we part ways here, man. This is Build Your Network. We've had over 500 episodes now and brought on a lot of great thought leaders and entrepreneurs and people all over the spectrum. And this one question I've asked to every single one of them. And so I'm curious to hear what your answer would be, especially in the light of your previous answer. Do you believe that who you know or what you know is more important in life in general? And why do you believe that? Who you know or what you know?
Oof. Oh my God. That's a tough one. I think who you know. It's my cheeky answer is it's who you know, because no matter how much of an idiot you are, if you know the right people, you'll be fine. Like, people cover for all your mistakes. But I think it comes back to that meaning thing. You know, it's what you know will get you far materially in the world. Mm-hmm. It will get you a nice, comfy place to stay and you know, some money in your bank account. But who you know will also get you those things, but it'll also get you something that those things can't give you, which is a sense of meaning and purpose.
Yeah. Love that answer, man. Couldn't agree more with you on that for sure. That's why I like the who, because it's a source of the what, right? Like I way more from getting around people who are way smarter than I am than I do just by reading a book or by watching a course or looking at a YouTube video or something. Like if I can spend some time with somebody, you know, then it always rubs off on me in a really positive way and increases the what in an exponential rather than in an incremental way. And then when you combine the fact that that's where you contrive a lot of purpose in life, I think the who just kind of stands out.
Yeah. Do you ever get anybody who says the what?
Yeah, actually the reason I started asking the question was I thought it was going to be like a lay down answer. Like everybody was going to say who, you know, and then we just chat about why that's the case, you know?
Yeah.
The question, I'd started getting a good amount of people that said what, you know, and then a lot of people will like make, you know, oh, it's what you know with who you know. It's who you know about what you know. And like, different answers for it. So it's been an interesting question to get 300, 400 plus answers for at this point.
Yeah. I imagine that there are certain contexts in life that, you know, it's if you're like running a nuclear power plant, I think what you know is much more important.
Yeah, there's got to be some industries where it might be a little bit more important on the
plane. Yeah. If you're flying a plane, I think what you know is a little more important. But yeah, it's super interesting to think about.
Well, cool, man. I appreciate you taking the time. I know we got to get going here. So before we take off, what's the best place online where our listeners can go to connect with you the most?
MarkManson.net. I've got a weekly newsletter that I send out every Monday morning. It's called Mindfuck Monday. Send out 3 ideas each week to help people be less awful humans. So check that out. And then the books are literally anywhere you can buy a book. So
markmanson.net. Head over there, check out some of the things that Mark has going on. I subscribe to maybe 2 or 3 newsletters, and Mark's is one of them. So if you're listening to this, I place a lot of value in the stuff that Mark puts out there. And I highly recommend going and checking out some of the, especially his newsletter. And then the little tidbits and stuff that he posts over on Instagram too, I find extremely helpful. So make sure to go follow Mark. If you have not read his books, they are literally 2 of the books that I have on like my top 10 all-time reading list. Please go check them out, download them audio or physical copy, whatever you like to do. They're there, and I promise you that they will positively affect your life. Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show today, brother. This is a fantastic time chatting with you here the last few minutes.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
That's it for this episode. If you want to connect with Travis and other like-minded people who also listen to the show, then you're going to want to head over to travischappell.com/group to join his free Facebook group, Podcast to Profit. Travis will see you there. And remember to leave every relationship better than you found it.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.